Accession number 30,001, Mr. Peter Hurst, Royal 26. Now, what sort of operational flights were you doing once you got back to Stella? What's the sort of flight you were doing?
Well, it was mainly practice flying. We did formation, air-to-ground firing, did quite a bit of air-to-ground firing. And then I've got here four trips when we were doing a fly-past rehearsal. I can't remember what the fly-past was for. And then I did air-to-ground. That finished up November. Then into December. Did a low-level strike on a practice one, of course, on Diepholz. I can't remember where Diepholz is. And then we were doing formation practicing and one thing and another. So during November and October.
Now, I think the next thing then is this business of de Burgh went on leave.
And that's right. That's right.
Now, there's this thing about how de Burgh organised the flying, and you had different ideas. Now, what's
yes.
interesting, though? Tell us about the changes you introduced.
Well, I'll tell you, when de Burgh was in charge, he used to tell the ground crews, he said, I want every aircraft that is serviceable on the line to fly. And then any others will be obviously being worked on the engineering point of view. So therefore you never knew how many aircraft you were going to have on the line. You might have had about 18 aircraft on the squadron, and you might have 13 one day, you might have 9 the next, and so you never really knew how many aircraft you were going to have. So therefore, the flight commanders found it somewhat difficult to plan their flying program, because they never knew how many aircraft they were going to have at their fingertips. And they used to get a bit fed up with that. And also, the ground crew used to get very fed up with not knowing how they were going to sort of service the aircraft when they came back. Some aircraft came back, and the chap reported an unserviceability for some reason or other. So that would have to be taken off the line. And that would reduce the numbers, whatever number they started with. And it was, to my mind, it was an absolute mess up in the way of preparing a flying program. And when he went on leave, I decided to change it immediately. And I said to the ground crew, the NCOs, on the engineering side, I said, look, while the CO's on leave, I'm going to be running the squadron, and I'm going to do it differently to the way he did. And instead of having maximum numbers on the line all the time, I want 6 aircraft per flight every morning. If you've got 8 or 9 serviceable, it doesn't matter, keep 2 or 3 in reserve, but put 6 on the line so that the flight commanders know how many aircraft they've got to play with, and they can prepare their flying program accordingly. Similarly with you, you know that if one comes back from an airborne trip as unserviceable, all you've got to do is to pick one of the serviceable ones off and replace it, keeping 6 on the line. And they said, well, it sounds good. So I said, right, well, we'll give it a whirl. And after about a week, they said, this is fantastic. We all know where we stand. And the flight commanders, well, preparing the flying programs as well, they knew that they had 6 aircraft they could use and do what they liked with, formation, air-to-ground firing, or whatever. And everybody was very happy about the system. And so I kept that going until Dickie de Burgh came back for leave. And he got back to his old-fashioned system.
So he just reverted.
He reverted.
Yeah. He talked to you about it. I mean, you know, because he must have noticed that it changed.
Well, I mean, we were getting more flying hours in on a regular throughout the day because we had six aircraft going all the time. Yes, he said, "Well, I don't like your system. I'm going to revert to my system." I said, "Yes, I understand. You know, you want to do. You're the boss." So there we go. But it wasn't so long after that that I was posted. I was promoted on the 1st of January 1954 to squadron leader.
Now, you'd been squadron leader before, but were there any celebrations? Because it seems to be some celebrations, you know, in your
body. Yes, yes. I didn't know that I was going to be promoted then, and it wasn't until it was the 1st of January we were. It was a holiday or semi-holiday of some sort. I was at home in my married quarter with my wife and my young daughter. She's about 7 years old. And there's a hell of a noise going on outside the front door. And all the squadron boys got out. They got to hear it somehow before me. And they came out singing happy birthday to me. Not happy. Happy promotion, not happy birthday. Happy promotion.
Happy scraper.
Happy scraper. That was
scraper. Sorry.
Yes, yes, scraper. Yes, because you know with the squadron leader, you have a thin. You have your flight attendant has two thick bands. Squadron leader has two thick bands, but with a thin one in between. So the thicker ones are widened out a bit to make room for the one in between. So you had rather like 2.5 rings, and that was all squadron leaders have that, still have it. That's right, they were singing Happy Scraper. I thought, what the bloody hell are they singing about? So I went to the front door, and it was a holiday, if I remember rightly, and I was in my dressing gown still, I think, because it was quite early. And so they told me, I said, "Well, you'll be leaving us soon, they've decided to promote it." So I invited them all in, and we had a drink on the strength of it, and it started off. It's been quite a happy day.
Now, you got your own squadron then, didn't you?
Yes, I was posted about 2 weeks later, and I was posted to command number 5 squadron at Wunstorf.
Now, is that second tactical? What is it?
Second tactical air force. But before I went to take them over, the AOC of number 2 group, which was the group that commanded the stations and squadrons in Germany, was commanded by an Air Vice Marshal Hallingspart, who knew me from the days when he was a wing commander, going back to 1940. And I got a message through station headquarters that he wanted to see me. So I went down there to see him, and he said, he knew me, calls me Peter, you know, he knew me a long time. He said, "Peter, I want you to take over 5 squadron." They'd been in a bit of a state lately. He said, "They've had a lot of accidents. They've had 2 fatals. I don't think the squadron has been run very well." I knew the chap who I was taking over from.
Who was it?
What was his name? Forgotten it.
It'll come to you or not.
Yeah. Anyway, he said, "I know you're old, I know you're well experienced, and I want you to try and pull 5 squadron round." And I went there and...
And what state was it in?
Well, the chap's not working very well together as a team, and that applied to ground staff, ground crews, and... the pilots as well. They were all right, doing their best, I suppose. But the lead they had from the top, in my opinion, was not all that it should have been.
And what do you think the role of squadron leader was? You know, can you just go through what exactly you were responsible for, in charge of? What was your job?
Well, you're as a squadron leader, in command of a squadron, you're responsible for everything. You're responsible for the flying, the amount of flying, and then all the ground crews, and had to look after their livelihoods and conditions. Had to check where their barrack blocks to see that they were up to standard, and had to cover all that side of things in addition to looking after the flying. And then, of course, with the pilots, getting them together, working well, two flights, getting a good atmosphere between them all, and generally...
Are you responsible for tactics,
Oh, yes. Yes, as well. That's on the flying side. Yes.
Would you fly as well?
Oh, yes.
As a full member of the squadron?
Yes. Yes. Oh, I used to do quite a lot of flying. I used to lead the formations if we were doing a squadron formation. I've got here close and tactical formation, low level battle formation, and I used to lead them. And because I was on the Venom, with five squadron, I'd been on the Vampire.
Now, let's do the Venom then, and then we'll do how you improve. What was your opinion of the Venom? It's the Venom Mark One, is it?
Mark One, yes. It was a very good aeroplane.
In what way?
It was slightly bigger than the Vampire, reinforced, stronger, more powerful, had double the power of the Vampire, and the performance was very good, and it was particularly good at high altitude, anything above 35,000 feet up to 45,000 feet, that sort of level. It was very good at altitude.
Was it pleasant to fly?
Yes, yes it was. It was a good aeroplane, the Venom. And it wasn't so long after the FB1 that we got the FB4.
That's a bit later, yeah, you do get Mark IV, yeah. We'll do it now. How did that differ?
Oh, it was a more powerful engine, and some modifications to the to the airframe. Can't remember what they were now, but it was quite a bit better than the Mark I. And just looking to see.
We'll come.
I think it was after the they took the Venom ones away because they replaced them with Vampires. We were flying Vampires for pretty well the whole of May in 1954.
Right, now, hang on, that's a bit... Let's talk about the... how were you going to improve this unit? You've been spoken to by Halling's part.
Yeah. Oh, yes, he said to me...
What were you going to do about it? What did you do about it?
Well, I got all the pilots together and spoke to them. And I said, I'd been told... I told them, I said, the AOC had sent for me and told me that... you had a few problems in this squadron, and while I'm here, we're going to sort them out. And I changed one or two things. Can't remember now exactly what. First of all, he was another one, rather like de Berg, didn't really have an organised flying plan, and flew everything that was serviceable. That similar sort of thing to de Berg.
So you brought in this idea of six aircraft of flight,
yep.
and a proper service.
Yes,
program.
Yes. And the ground crews liked that, and they were They fully supported me. And now then, after a bit, the flight commanders did as well. And the morale seemed to shoot up throughout the whole of the squadron, not only the officers and the aircrew, but the ground crew as well.
How could you tell?
Well, on two or three occasions, people used to come up to me, the NCOs, senior NCOs, and they told me, they said, how much happier they were. And they said that since I'd been in charge of the squadron, and they enjoyed the atmosphere so much more. And I was getting the same sort of reaction from the pilots.
You actually had a squadron song written. How much was it written at the time? It's in your book. That's only a jokey thing.
Yes. At Wunstorf, there were three squadrons. It was number 5, number 11, and number 266. And one or two of my chaps, they really got a good feel. And they were happy. And between them, they had organised this song. And it was... 5 squadron for me, 5 squadron for me. If you're not 5 squadron, you're no use to me. 266 are a shower, 11 are two, but the old fighting fifth is the pride of them all. And that was... did I put that in the book?
Yes, there's a slightly different version, but I suspect the last line changes about whatever mood you're in. That's a sign of good morale.
Yes, and... then on Saturday nights in the bar, and they used to sing this, and of course you used to get the other two squadrons a bit needled. But
now you also used to, the one thing, you used to get all the engines to start together when you were, you know, when you were when you were taking off. Tell me about that.
Yes.
Why did you do that?
There was a cartridge starters. It didn't have battery starters. And you just push a button, the cartridges are put in, and you fire a button, and it fires this cartridge off, which is a powerful cookie and turns the engine over. And once the engine starts to go over, you can then get the ignition firing the fuel. And if you all push the buttons together...
How many? A squadron or...
As many as you like. But I used to sometimes have, say, a flight, sometimes a squadron. And I would then call out, right, start up, get ready for start up. And I'd go, right, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, start. And they'd all push the buttons at the same time. And you see this black smoke come out of the out of each aircraft where the starter... sort of like a little rocket, really. I used to belch this black smoke. I've got a photograph of it.
And this is just for effect?
Partly, yes. But also, it meant that we all started together, and then you say, all right, then we start taxiing out. So there's no time waiting for people to start up on their own as individuals. And you knew that everybody was ready to go.
Now, you used to go to Silt for armament practice camp. Tell me about that.
Yes.
Well, twice a year, I think.
Yes.
Now, Silt, what exactly was an armament practice camp?
Silt, do you know Silt, the island off the west coast of Germany? And up there they had towing aircraft. They used to tow drogues. We used to fire at them. But the idea was... To practice live gunnery. That was the purpose of going to Silt. And you did two types. You did hitting ground targets on air-to-ground attacks, and then the other one was firing at this drogue, which was being towed by an aircraft.
And what was it like? How realistic was it?
Oh, it was really quite good. It gave the chaps, first of all, the feel of firing the guns, because you couldn't do it anywhere else other than on ranges. We did have a range but we could near Wunstorf. But you could only use it for air to ground, no air to air, which is you could do at Sylt.
And how would you measure the score?
Well, what they used to do was to excuse me. I'm going to drink water in a minute. They coloured the ammunition, the heads of it, and each aircraft would have a different colour. And what they used to do is just sort of paint the bullet part of the ammunition, and then when you had this white drogue, a big, a very big drogue, probably almost as long as this, you know. And so the colours would come up if you'd hit it on whatever colour you'd been given. And therefore they were able to count the number of hits you had.
Was there a competition within the squadron or between squadrons or both?
No, it was just within the squadron. No, not between squadrons.
And anything else you'd do at the Sylt Ranges?
No, just have a look at the...
You seem to have had pilot attack instructors. I'm not quite, are they just the latest?
Oh, yeah. They had what they call PAIs, pilot attack instructors, who were based at Sylt. And when a squadron went up there, they put two of their PAIs with each squadron. And they would perhaps give some advice about the attacking these targets, and because they were doing it all the time. They stayed with the squadron. We used to go there for a month. They stayed with the squadron for the whole month.
Were they useful, do you think?
Oh, yes. Definitely. Yeah.
Now, anything else about you took the time of five squadron? What are any characters you remember from the squadron?
Yes, there were quite a few. There was one chap from Thailand. He was Prince. Prince Nicky Farrenand. Had loads of money. Had a couple of Rolls Royces in this country, and then he bought himself two brand new cars in Germany. One was a big American. What do you call it? One of these things that carry passengers. And then he also had a Mercedes, bought himself a brand new Mercedes saloon car out there. So he was quite a character. And I've got photographs of them all. But the other flight commander was a chap named Tommy Dawkins, who didn't stay all that long because he was due for posting. The tour was 2.5 years. And after about 6 months, his tour was up and he was posted and replaced with another chap. The chap who was posted from the squadron at Fassberg, his name was Paddy English. And strangely enough, only about 2 months ago, he died. And it was in the Telegraph, and I saw it. And I wrote to his wife. And I'd never met her before, because he wasn't married when he was in the squadron. And I had a nice letter back from her. They were the two flight commanders. Nicky Verenend hadn't been there long by the time I got there, so he was more or less with me all through. And we had good atmosphere in the squadron, good atmosphere, not only amongst the aircrew, the pilots, but the ground crew as well. The whole squadron was on top line.
What was the social life like?
Oh, it was very good. We used to occasionally have a squadron party when we all went with all the ground crew, and usually held in the airman's mess. And we had a couple of those. didn't have them all that often, but when we did have them, they were well organised. But as far as the officers were concerned, of course, we used to have a drink in the mess bar and have a chat. We didn't used to drink to get drunk or anything like that, just a social basis. But on Saturday nights, we used to have a few more than normal. And we had an annex to the officers' mess at Wunstorf, and it was there was a big lake called Steinhudemir, which was about 5 or 6 miles away to the north. And on the edge of that there was a lovely old house. I think it had been Goering's holiday home or something like that. And we took it over and used it as a part of our officers' mess. And we had a German chap and his wife running it, and he'd been an air gunner in the Luftwaffe, and he was a very good chap, used to run it well, and we had a big open air area with marble floor, and we sometimes used to get some music on and go do a bit of dancing out there. And they also had another unusual thing. Any person who was visiting that part of the mess, this sub-part, if they hadn't been there before, they had a bit of their tie chopped off, the tail end of their tie, and they were pinned on the wall with their name underneath. And there was one wall full of these ties, so everyone who hadn't been there before lost a bit of their tie. And became quite well known for that.
So it was a pleasant time socially as well.
Yes.
Now, you used to do sorties to test the Britain air defences.
Yes.
This is where you're pretending to be the baddies, or, you know, of whichever sort, you know.
Yes.
Can you tell me about those?
Well, we used to take off when the it was run in conjunction with the UK defences, and we would operate from Germany as the so-called enemy. And we used to fly, we had long-range tanks fitted on our Venoms, so it gave us about, we could stay airborne for about 3.5 hours. And I always remember on one occasion, we decided to cross the UK coast as dawn was breaking. We took off in the dark at Wunstorf, and it took us about an hour to get from Wunstorf to the UK coast, best part of anyway. And we used to fly in wide formation, we didn't fly in close formation. And we took off, as I say, in the dark, and when we got to the coast, the Norfolk coast by Norwich, there, that's where we crossed in. And I could see that the UK defences were sending up some fighters to try to intercept us. And we were flying at 40,000 feet. So it was quite high for the equivalent of 8 miles high. So I could see these meteors and hunters. They'd been scrambled and they were coming up to try and intercept us. And we didn't take any avoiding action. We just flew a set courses. And we didn't move from those courses. And if they came to attack us, we just carried on flying in the same way. So, they hunted.
Why was that? Because that's not very realistic, is it?
No, it was just to give, yes, and to give them. We hadn't got enough fuel to stay over long anyway. But it was to give them the opportunity to intercept us at high altitude.
Now, could they intercept? Did they manage it?
Oh, yes. Yes, they did. But the hunters were more, they were better than the meteors at that. But, they used to get up there all right. And used to fly around us once they'd found us and do some mimic attacks on us.